Blog Talk Radio.
Around the convention center
so that no cars could pass through. It seemed as though most people at the event caught cabs back home, so the people who were hurt the most by the blocked intersections were the D.C. residents, not the people from the AFP event. Were you afraid they would become physically violent with you? Did they threaten you with violence? A very large group of male protesters began to surround me and chant F. Michelle Fields, while others screamed in my face for working at the Daily Caller and being a right-wing extremist. There were very few female protesters, but they were civil towards me. All of the people who harassed me were male protesters. At one point, someone threw water at me, so I immediately went to speak to a police officer who then spoke to some of the protesters individually about their behavior. Although the police officer tried to control the situation, the individuals continued to harass me throughout the evening. How so? Occupy DC assigned someone to follow me around the entire evening with a camera, documenting my every move. He was always a few steps behind me, harassing and filming me. I was only able to interview a handful of people last night because Occupy DC protesters would jump in front of my camera and interrupt the interview. Did any of the protesters try to calm the others down and get them to behave civilly? Occupy DC was only concerned with trying to get other protesters to behave civilly when the Daily Caller camera was around. If my camerawoman and I were around when someone was doing something that was clearly illegal or out of control, Occupy DC would start screaming, "Stop! Daily Caller is right behind you. They're going to get it on camera." Did they seem to have a coherent message? They had no coherent message other than to make sure Charles Koch, Cook and his friends didn't get out of the building. Were they blocking all the traffic or just fancy cars? Occupy DC only allowed non-luxury cars and government buses to pass through. At one point, an African-American male came by in an SUV and pleaded with protesters to let him and his two-year-old son get through so they could go home. One of the protesters shouted, "Sorry, but you have no power right now and your son can't save you."
How many protesters do you think there were? A couple hundred. What was the demographic makeup of the protesters as far as you could tell? Did they seem particularly impoverished, or did they seem just to be political radicals? Did you get the sense that they were all Occupy DC people, or were there activists from elsewhere as well? Most of the protesters were rowdy young men with either an iPhone, BlackBerry, or an expensive DSLR camera in their hands. And many of the protesters were recording from iPhones and iPads. I'm not sure I would consider someone with an iPhone or iPad and Mac computer to be impoverished.
Well, they just graduated from college.
Or whatever they are. Not all of them are impoverished.
They just can't find jobs.
A lot of them have jobs. It's just that they're losing them, or they're
not jobs that are equal to what they were educated to do.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's a lot of problems.
So they're working, but they're not working up to their capacity.
But I just thought it was funny because
that's how she saw it.
She saw it, and she saw it quite differently than what most people see it. Let's see. This was another very interesting one that happened this weekend. Occupy Boston takes over the Israeli consulate, this happened on, I believe, Sunday. But Occupy Boston protesters in the U.S. have stormed the Israeli consulate in the city and held a brief sit-in in the building's lobby. On Friday, activists gathered calling for the liberation of Palestine, angry at Israel for intercepting an aid flotilla on its way to the besieged Gaza Strip. Protesters chanted slogans such as, "Not another nickel nor another dime, no more money for Israel's crimes, and Viva, Viva Palestina." I like these guys. They're demanding the departure of Israeli consulate officials from the U.S. The protest is part of the global movement against social and economic inequalities and corporate greed. Participants make clear that they are not anti-Semites, but anti-Zionists, critical of the Israeli government current policies. And the Occupy movement emerged after a group of Americans on September 17th gathered in New York's financial district to protest against the unjust distribution of wealth in the U.S. and the excessive influence of big corporations on American politics. Despite mass arrests and widespread police crackdown, the movement has now spread to U.S. major cities as well as to other countries, including Australia, Britain, Germany, Italy, Spain, Ireland, and Portugal. And this was written by the
Press TV,
which is Iranian television. And I thought that was kind of interesting.
Do you have the article on the Rothschild banks?
Yes, I do. And hang on one second here.
This kind of plays right into this movement.
Yeah. I also have a short video I want to play tonight about the Euro kaput. Euro could be dead by the end of November. So I'm going
to want the British to bail it out, and the British don't want to.
You want me to? What did you want me to do?
The Rothschilds on the banks.
That's not on here. That's elsewhere. Let's see. Where is that? It's right here somewhere. Where is it? And there. Group LCF Rothschild. As of the year 2000, there were seven countries without a Rothschild-owned central bank. Afghanistan, Iraq, Sudan, Libya, Cuba, North Korea, and Iran. Then along came the convenient terror of 9/11, and soon Iraq and Afghanistan had been added to the list, leaving only five countries without a central bank owned by the Rothschild family: Sudan, Libya, Cuba, North Korea, and Iran. We all know how fast the central bank of Benghazi was set up, and the only countries left in 2011 without a central bank owned by the Rothschild family are Cuba, North Korea, and Iran. And these monomaniacal speculators in the West, via their nuke-weaponed ally Israel, are blatantly gagging to get the central bank of Iran set up, and you know it. That's what I thought would be interesting.
Yeah.
Let me just go back here because I had some stuff here that I wanted to get involved with. Hang on a second. I hope to play this tonight because it shows, I have a great video here that talks about hemp oil cures cancer and diabetes.
Mm.
Yeah. And let's see. Wall Street firms have already earned more under Obama than during entire Bush presidency.
How about that?
Is that amazing or not? What do you think?
Yep.
Should we read that?
Yeah, I think we should. Okay, this is another reason why protesters are protesting the occupiers.
Yeah, let me read that. By the HuffPost Business.
Wall Street firms have already earned more under Obama than during the entire Bush presidency. That's amazing.
Now,
Wall Street firms have earned more profits so far under President Obama than during all 8 years of George W. Bush's presidency, according to the Washington Post. The securities industry earned... Oh, what happened there? In a minute, folks. Yep, there it is. Oh, we're okay.
That's good.
Okay. Sometimes we have things that pull out here.
Yeah, plug pull out.
We had a plug
and
pull out.
And disable one of our computers. We are operating with two computers tonight.
The securities industry earned $82.52 billion in profits during the first 2.5 years of Obama's presidency, compared to $77.17 billion total under President Bush, according to data compiled by the Washington Post, giving legs to the claim that even while Obama has publicly denounced fat cat bankers on Wall Street, banks are now profitable as ever, and more so. But the discrepancy is in a large part due to the $24.75 billion loss within the securities industry. No, I'm sorry. Leo just asked me if I couldn't see. within the securities industry during the financial crisis of 2008, the last year of Bush's presidency, followed by a gain of $49.53 billion during the country's first year under Obama. Okay. This is more about numbers and manipulation and stuff. Let's see. Federal regulators did cave to Wall Street pressure in the aftermath of the Troubled Asset Relief Program. However, according to a report from the program's Special Inspector General, the report alleged federal banking regulators under Obama allowed Citigroup, Wells Fargo, PNC, and Bank of America to leave the government's bailout program early in 2009, even though the Federal Reserve and the FDIC had recommended they spend more time shoring up their assets. The banks had lobbied to leave TARP early because they wanted to avoid restrictions on executive compensation, according to the report. They shouldn't have been allowed to do that. I mean, they should have had restrictions on executive compensation. I mean, this whole thing is just awful.
Isn't it, though?
Additionally, some of the Obama administration's aim at curbing excessive Wall Street profits have yet to take effect or even be written, so their direct effect on profitability has yet to be realized. Nonetheless, major U.S. banks have struggled this year on the whole, with Goldman Sachs reporting its second loss ever as a public company, and Bank of America stock price plunging over the last 10 months. The financial industry has already announced a slew of mass layoffs, and New York Comptroller recently estimated that Wall Street could lose 10,000 more jobs by the end of 2012. Still, corporations have boomed during Obama's presidency, even as unemployment has remained high. Corporate profits hit an all-time high of $1.93 trillion in the second quarter of 2011, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis, up from an earlier all-time high in the fourth quarter of 2010. Corporate profits accounted for 88% of all economic growth during the first 18 months of the end of the recession, compared to just 53% of economic growth after the 2001 recession under Bush. So, I mean, what does that mean exactly? Let's see. The Republican National Committee slammed the Obama administration following the Post story, urging voters on its blog to Occupy Obama, a reference to the Occupy Wall Street movement, which targets banks' profitability at the expense of ordinary Americans, among other issues.
Okay. That's what's going on there. So Obama's no big deal. I mean, he is the masses, he is the master of manipulation for the ones.
For the business. For big corporations, he certainly seems to give them a lot of support.
Yeah. We're going to have time tonight as Larry will only be on for 15 minutes. And then we have Woody in the Ring coming up that time. But I wanted to read this one. Why Iceland should be in the news, but is not.
Hmm.
I think that's an important one.
If your folks remember that Iceland was going bankrupt and they refused to accept or pay back.
Right. And this is from the South. This article is, well, it's not that long. That's kind of important. South African Civil Society Information Service.
Oh, okay.
There you got this from.
It's by Dina Stryker?
Yeah. An Italian radio program story about Iceland's ongoing revolution is a stunning example of how little our media tells us about the rest of the world. Americans may remember that at the start of the 2008 financial crisis, Iceland's literally went bankrupt. The reasons were mentioned only in passing, and since then, this little-known member of the European Union fell back into oblivion. As one European country after another fails or risks failing, imperiling the euro, and with repercussions for the entire world, the last thing the power that be want is for Iceland to become an example, and here's why. 5 years of pure neoliberal regime have made Iceland, population 320,000, no army, and one of the richest countries in the world. In 2003, all the country's banks were privatized, and in an effort to attract foreign investors, they offered an online banking whose minimal cost allowed them to offer relatively high rates of return. And the accounts called Ice Save attracted many English and Dutch small investors. But as investors grew, so did the bank's foreign debt. In 2003, Iceland's debt was equal to 200 times its gross national product. But in 2007, it was 900%. Can you imagine that? All right. And the 2008 world financial crisis was the group, the coup de grace. The three main Icelandic banks, Landbanki, I can't even pronounce these things, Kaupthing and Glitnir, went belly up and were nationalized, while the kroner lost 85% of its value with respect to the euro. And at the end of the year, Iceland declared bankruptcy. Contrary to what could be expected, the crisis resulted in Icelanders recovering their sovereign rights through a process of direct participatory democracy that eventually led to a new constitution, but only after much pain.
Good for them.
But it's interesting how they did this. They did it openly. They constructed their constitution openly on the internet. And protests and riots. Geir Harder, the prime minister of a social democratic coalition government, negotiated a $2,100,000 loan, to which the Nordic countries added another $2.5 million. But the foreign financial community pressured Iceland to impose drastic measures. The FMI and the European Union wanted to take over its debt, claiming this was the only way for the country to pay back Holland and Great Britain, who had promised to reimburse their citizens.
Protests and riots continued, eventually forcing the government to resign. Elections were brought forward to April 2009, resulting in a left-wing coalition which condemned the neoliberal economic system, but immediately gave in to its demands that Iceland pay off a total of 3.5 million euros. This required each Icelandic citizen to pay 100 euros a month, or about $130, for 15 years at 5.5% interest to pay off a debt incurred by private parties vis-a-vis another private party. It was the last straw that broke the reindeer's back. What happened next was extraordinary. The belief that citizens had to pay for the mistakes of a financial monopoly, that an entire nation must be taxed to pay off private debts, was shattered, transforming the relationship between citizens and their political institutions, and eventually driving Iceland's leaders to the side of their constituents. The head of state, Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, refused to ratify the law that would have made Iceland's citizens responsible for its bankers' debt and accepted calls for a referendum. Of course, the international community only increased the pressure on Iceland. Great Britain and Holland threatened dire reprisals that would isolate the country. As Icelanders went to vote, foreign bankers threatened to block any aid from the IMF. The British government threatened to freeze Icelanders' savings and checking accounts. As Grimson said, we were told that if we refused, the international community's conditions would become the Cuba of the North. But if we had accepted, and we would have become the Haiti of the North. How many times have I written that when Cuba sees the dire state of their neighbor Haiti, they count themselves lucky? In the March 2010 referendum, 93% voted against repayment of the debt. The IMF immediately froze its loan, but the revolution, though not televised in the United States, would not be intimidated. With the support of a furious citizenry, the government launched civil and penal investigations into those responsible for the financial crisis. Interpol put out an international arrest warrant for the ex-president of Kaupthing, Sigdur Inarison, as the other bankers implicated in the crash fled the country. But Icelanders didn't stop there. They decided to draft a new constitution that would free the country from the exaggerated power of international finance and virtual money. The one in use had been written when Iceland gained its independence from Denmark in 1918, the only difference with the Danish constitution being the word president replaced the word king. To write the new constitution, the people of Iceland elected 25 citizens from among 522 adults not belonging to any political party, but recommended by at least 30 citizens. This document was not the work of a handful of politicians, but was written on the internet. The constituents' meetings are streamed online, and citizens can send their comments and suggestions, witnessing the document as it takes shape. The constitution that eventually emerges from this participatory democratic process will be submitted to the parliament for approval after the next elections. Ooh, this is so cool. Some readers will remember that Iceland's 9th century agrarian collapse was featured in Jared Diamond's book by the same name. Today, the country is recovering from its financial collapse in ways just the opposite of those generally considered unavoidable, as confirmed yesterday by the news and the head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, to Fareed Zakaria. The people of Greece have been told that the privatization of their public sector is the only solution, and those of Italy, Spain, and Portugal are facing the same threat. They should look to Iceland. Refusing to bow to foreign interests, the small country stated loud and clear that the people are sovereign. That's why it's not in the news anymore.
But the only difference is, and the only difference between 320,000 people,
yeah,
all right, and 320 million people trying to create a constitution is a little hard. It's a little bit more difficult.
But it is. It's a great thing, though.
Isn't it great? Yeah. No, they're fierce people, and I really respect their tenacity.
I do. I think it's wonderful said no, and nothing's happened. They're doing fine.
I know. Russell Tribunal in Palestine finds Israel guilty of crimes of apartheid and persecution. That one was very interesting.
I did read that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what the Russell Tribunal is exactly.
I wasn't either when I read this article, but
I
believe
I'm going to have to look that up on the internet because I've never heard of it.
The Russell Tribunal is a group of eminent people that was elected to investigate this, Israel. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. It didn't tell from the article if it was
how that came to be.
From the UN or from...
Yeah, where it evolved from, so I really don't know.
The world courts or whatever. But we can probably get to this a little later. But billions of dollars moved in bank transfers, demonstrations. Bank branches and ATMs across the country saw a surge of traffic during the last month, which pinnacled over the weekend as Americans from coast to coast accessed their accounts and withdrew their money and went elsewhere from the major big banks. Mm-hmm. Many of them went into credit unions. But October 5th was actually the transfer your money day.
Oh, okay.
All right, by Occupy Wall Street. I wanted to get to this one. Because this was very fascinating. The euro could be dead also. Maybe we get time for this one later, but I wanted to show hemp oil cures cancer and diabetes.
You only have 2 minutes.
Yeah, and I won't. It's a short video, but I'll play it later in the health section after Larry's interview. And this one as well is fascinating. But hold on a second here. We'll get there in a second. Okay. Just want to see if there's anything else quickly that I had posted. Oh, yeah. This one was quite sick. John Lennon's tooth sells for more than $31,000 at the auction. Okay?
I wasn't interested in
that. My question was, what kind of sick 1%er would buy this? All right? Can you imagine that?
I'm not interested in that.
Yeah, but it's just the Tooth Fairy's trash became another man's treasure Saturday when a discolored molar that once belonged to John Lennon was
so
put up for auction. Isn't it, though? It's really, just disgusted me. But anyway, we'll come back in a minute to this stuff, but I have to go, I have to call Larry. Just 1 second here, I'm going to do that.
You have something short that you can play while you're calling him, or I can read?
Actually, I'm just going to call him right now.
Oh, okay.
Just take 1 second. So if you bear with me for 1 second, we will be able to do that, and hopefully he will answer.
Okay. He's on the pickup line.
Yeah. And we're calling his cell, so hopefully he'll be able to pick up. And Larry Dorman is the public affairs coordinator for
AFSCME, Council for
Union.
Out of New Britain, Connecticut.
And
they represent, it's American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And that they also represent the blood workers, at the people who draw the blood, and I think who drive the trucks at the Red Cross. And they represent, like,
Hello?
People in your town office. People in your town are in that union. So Larry should be there.
You've reached the voicemail of Larry Dorman, Council for Public Affairs. Please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks.
We'll call him back.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Yeah, hi, Larry. It's Leo and Lila. You can call us at 646-915-9505. Or we can try you back in just a second or two.
Yeah, we'll try you back, too.
All right.
Sounds like he's busy.
Yeah.
He's on the picket line protesting the Red Cross and their treatment of, I think it's some of the people who draw the blood workers, and they're concerned about the safety of the Red Cross blood drive.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll be able to talk to him.
Yeah, I want to hear more about that.
And let's try that one more time. Then we will try to.
We're calling right on our computer.
We're calling Larry Dorman again, so hopefully Larry will answer.
You've reached the voicemail of Larry Dorman, Council for Public Affairs. Please leave.
We'll try him again
later. We'll try him again.
In about 5 minutes or so.
Yeah.
So let's go to that audio. How long is that audio?
Hang on 1 second. I'm going to go to it.
We'll play a little something that we had for you lined up, folks.
Here's something I wanted to mention as well before we go to that. I wanted to mention the 2012 federal budget.
All right.
It's really kind of frightening.
I didn't see this.
Yeah, the 200. This is a friend of mine sent this posted on Facebook. But 2012 federal budget discretionary spending, 59% of our budget is going, or $553 billion is going to military spending. All right.
That's the Department of Defense, Veteran Affairs, and Homeland Security.
Right. So 2% goes to agriculture, 2% to justice, 2% goes to energy, 4% to the Department of State, 4% goes to
housing.
Now, this is how $1.34 trillion of our tax dollars are going to be spent in the year 2012. 6% goes to education. 6% goes to health and human services, and 15% goes to transportation, labor, space, et cetera.
Okay. And we got rid of our space program so that we can beat up everybody in the world, 59%.
59% of our federal budget, our $553 billion, is going to the military, Department of Defense, Veteran Affairs, and Homeland Security. I mean, that's absolutely...
That's so you can be molested at airports.
That's absolutely sick, yeah. Homeland freaking security. All right? It's unbelievable.
Ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. It's totally ridiculous. And, let's see. World's Most Powerful Now. I got so many here. So many good ones. This one really kind of bothered me a lot when I read it. And this was from by Ron Paul, okay?
Uh-huh. I used to really like a lot of what he had to say.
Yeah, but I don't like the way, I don't like his attitude. See, he's kind of a racist, and he's kind of a shit, and, you know, and it really, it's starting to come out in a lot of ways. I don't know.
Mm.
His attitude toward Occupy Wall Street really, well, he should be really embracing this thing. He's not.
Ron Paul, Tea Party Godfather, says Occupy are all about handouts. Oh, okay. How about jobs? They'd like a job.
Yeah. Carroll, Iowa. Ron Paul outlined that he believed, what he believed was the difference between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. Says some are demonstrating because they're scared to death they won't get their handouts. And Paul said yesterday. And the other half are demonstrating because they're sick and tired of paying for it. I'm on the side of the sick and tired of paying for it. Paul's popularity has risen since 2008, largely because of the Tea Party. And he doesn't lead in polling in any state, but he is routinely in the top three in states like Iowa and New Hampshire. It was a very short quote, but it tells you a lot about the guy. You know what I mean?
Mm.
That, yeah, he just doesn't get it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He doesn't get it. And this one did bother me quite a bit. The neo-Marxist globalist engineers of leaderless Occupy Wall Street. Now, whether or not this is true, I don't know.
I don't know either.
But it sure did kind of scare me a little bit when I read it. And they're talking about... The guy makes a case for...
I read this article, and it's a very, very long, long article. And you can't really read it all.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I'm going to refer you to the Gulag Bound, okay?
Yeah, folks
website.
Should read it for themselves.
Gulag Bound website, and just go Gulag Bound, and you'll see the article. And it really... I don't know. I don't really believe it totally, but
just
I do believe
that little caption. Read that little caption at the top.
A revolution against the controlling elite that thrusts off the tyranny of their central banking, the indoctrination in their schools, the lies of their media, and the brainwashing of their entertainment would be a welcome development. But a revolution that appears to free the oppressed masses from the ultra-rich, while it is manipulated behind the scenes by the globalist elite, will only lead to more enslavement.
And
that's what this article is about, like,
yeah.
Is stating that they're being manipulated, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've covered this, but it's very possible. But
it's like the Arab Spring.
Yeah.
That revolution
so many of these were manipulated.
Revolution made... For export right here in the United States.
Like the United States trained 5,000 activists to go over there. And
the people that have those NGOs that go over,
those are fronts. Exactly. So these
democracy in action. Yeah, right.
That's what it is. We haven't yet heard from our friend here, but I'm going to... Let's go on this one here. Hang on a second. I'm going to call Larry again. He must have been tied up.
Yeah, it's 8:38, so maybe you'll get him.
Maybe he's getting beat up or something.
I hope not. he might have been talking or speaking, you know.
Yeah, that could be. He
could have been speaking or doing something special.
So I'm going to I'm just going to dial him up here for 1 second, if you'll bear with me.
We'll turn him again.
Right.
We'll see how this goes.
That's
saying that we're calling. Oh, okay. Let's hope we get him. Doesn't sound like he's going to pick up.
You've reached the voicemail of Larry Dorman, Council 4, Public Affairs. Please leave your name, number, and a brief message, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks.
At the tone, please record your message. When you have finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options.
Yeah, hey, Larry. It's Leo and Lila again. Let me give you the phone number you can call when you're able, hopefully before 9. 646-915-9505. All right? Again, that's 646-915-9505. Okay. Thanks. And so when he's available, he'll call us.
He'll call us if he can. So we'll see what happens there.
Yeah.
He's on picket line duty.
In the meantime...
I hope they have quite a few people out there. That would be great.
It would be good, yeah. I was kind of interested to see what...
It's always nice to have him call right from the scene of the action, so hopefully he'll be able to get to us.
Yeah. I'm going to... let's slip away for a quick little music break. What do you think?
Okay.
Yeah, we got time.
Yeah.
And, we still got about 20 minutes. And I got this neat thing that I found today, and it's a Bob Dylan song.
Oh.
And I found it off a website today, and this is Mr. Tambourine Man, but it's a YouTube video, so I'm sure it's free to play. It was from his Newport Folk Festival, 1964. And let's listen to this. All right?
Yep.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man.
Guys, I was, got a little hung up on the, I'm at the Red Cross picket line.
Well, we figured you were doing picket line duty and doing the right thing.
Trying to extract myself so I could get to your call, so thanks for your patience.
Well, that was good of you to do that. Now, Larry, would you refresh our listeners about why you're on the picket line for the Red Cross when...
Sure.
When we had a finding that the Red Cross was really in violation, what happened to change?
What's happened is our union asked me at Council 4, we represent about 200 blood collection workers at the Connecticut Red Cross.
Yep.
And the workers have gone almost 3 years now without a contract. And most recently, the Red Cross has been trying to strip the workers of their right to bargain over health care. They want to take nurses off of blood drives, the remaining nurses who are part of our bargaining unit, many other contentious issues. And the National Labor Relations Board lodged a series of complaints against the company for violating our members' rights under law. And as you mentioned, a federal judge in New York City upheld the NLRB complaints this August and ordered the Red Cross to make our members whole. Unfortunately, the Red Cross is appealing and not showing any respect for the ruling. So after three or four good faith efforts on our part to try to negotiate with this company and reach a settlement, the workers just finally said enough is enough. We have to take a stand, and they went on strike last Thursday, and we have picket lines every day at the Farmington, Connecticut headquarters of the Red Cross.
Well, those workers are very brave to do this. And when will that appeal be heard? Is there a date on the docket for that?
No, at this point there isn't. And part of what we're trying to do is we have tried to keep communications open. If the Red Cross would come to the table and actually discuss a settlement that the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, would approve, that would certainly go a long way towards settling this dispute. But so there's no timetable. And as you guys both know all too well, the Republicans have been playing around with the National Labor Relations Board. They're preventing Obama from filling seats. They're delaying the hearing of cases. So, you know, the larger backdrop of what's going on in this country certainly is playing out here in terms of corporate greed, in terms of the government agency that's supposed to regulate labor rights. A whole lot of things are converging here, I think.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a rally tomorrow at noon. We're going to have Occupy Wall Street folks there. And we're going to have the Speaker of the House, Chris Donovan. It should be a good event.
And where is that going to be held, Larry?
Yeah, I invite anybody who's listening and all anybody who's out there anytime wants to hit the picket line in Farmington. But tomorrow's rally is 11:30 to 1, and it's 209 Farmington Avenue in Farmington, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that other unions show solidarity with that union?
We are certainly working that and hoping that, and I think they will. I want to be clear, we're not asking people not to give blood. We're asking them to, you know, perhaps look elsewhere, if possible, for their blood donations, go to Massachusetts or go to New York. You know, we're asking people really to, you get my email, so you'll be getting an email soon, to contact the company CEO and say treat the workers fairly. We don't want people to refrain from giving blood, Lila. This is not what we're trying to do here. But we are asking some very hard questions that if the Red Cross in Connecticut can't treat its workers with a modicum of respect, and these are the advocates and the protectors of blood donors, what's that mean ultimately for the quality, the safety, and the integrity of the blood supply?
What are they doing in other states? I mean, it's the Red Cross or the Red Cross in this country.
They're a powerful corporation. People really shouldn't be confused or misled by the humanitarian veneer. There are two pieces to the Red Cross, the disaster relief, which is an entirely separate component of the company, and the blood services division. And they've been on an anti-union campaign throughout the country. And this, I know you guys will appreciate this in a perverse way, but dates back to when Elizabeth Dole was the head of the National Red Cross, and she began the Dopey Bush's father appointed her. And she began kind of fundamentally dismantling the relationships organized labor had built up with the Red Cross. They adopted a much more aggressive anti-union strategy with regard to their blood services divisions, where many of the blood collection workers are unionized. So the labor problems kind of can, you know, you can trace their origin to this, and it's only gotten worse since then. Their board of directors has many, you know, kind of anti-union corporate people on it. And, you know, so we're fighting actually, you know, we're fighting the 1% here in this particular local fight.
Boy, you sure are. And how long will this strike continue?
As long as we can keep it going, Lila. The workers are spirited. They're determined. It's not easy. The weather's going to start getting unfriendly, as it already has, with the power outages. And but we're committed. You know, the negotiating team had meetings with the membership We certainly gave members, we had, as I say, we had some discussions about the timing of this in terms of going out during the outage and during the winter, but every time we go to the table, they behave worse than the previous session. So at some point, you kind of have to, draw your own line morally and say, we're going to fight. Members want to fight. And it's not,
I remember back in the 70s, when the blood mobile drivers, the Red Cross drivers, went on strike, and they won their demands. I had some friends of mine who were Red Cross drivers, and they did win. They were out for about a month, and And back then, the press wasn't too favorable for them. They were, back in those days, the Red Cross was a sainted
organization.
That's when I found out.
I think they still are, unfortunately.
That's when I found out about them, that what kind of an operation they really were, and refused to give to the United Way, because much of it went to donation went to the Red Cross. So I got a lot of criticism for that in the company that I was working for, but nevertheless, I learned a lesson, and I always kept that in the back of my head. So I side with you guys very, very strongly, and
I appreciate it.
So will you have a representative from Council 4 out there with the workers each day?
Yeah, I've been out there. Several of my colleagues have, and other unions are trying to stop by. Tomorrow we'll have a lot of folks. So, and if people go to our website, council4.org, it's the lead story. And in a couple of days, we'll have an email that people can send to the Connecticut CEO telling him to play fair with the workers. There's an address on there currently on our website for people want to make small contributions to a worker solidarity fund. But one of the nice things that happened was one of our union officers from the Red Cross local went down to the Occupy Wall Street / Hartford branch Saturday. Just this past Saturday, and actually they asked Nancy to speak, and so the Occupy Wall Street people want to encourage their folks to be a part of this struggle too, and that's a nice thing, and that's how we're going to win these fights nowadays.
You need everybody. You need everybody to be present at times like this.
We saw your president, the president of ASME, actually, was on...
he was on national news tonight.
Who was he on?
McAtee.
McAtee. And he was on with, I think he was on with Sharpton.
Al Sharpton,
tonight on MSNBC, but you're very, very frustrated with this jobs bill that's being held by Congress,
absolutely.
I mean, extremely so. I mean, it's the only good thing that's come out of the Obama administration for a long time, and for them to be holding up on it, they're just trying. It just appears to me, Larry, they're just trying to crush anything that's Democratic, anything that's coming out of Obama's out of the White House. They don't care.
Doesn't matter what it is.
It could be his food for babies. It doesn't matter what. You know what I mean?
That's my take exactly. Whatever,
just outright political, hatchetry,
But I have to say, I do try to step back and analyze things, and it's easier to be where I am than where these folks are. But when I go back to January, 24th or whatever, 2009, when Obama, right after he was sworn into office, and he did his version of the bailout, and whatever you think of the bailout, if you recall, no Republicans voted for that, and that was just a sure signal that the Republicans were going to play this kind of hardball. They were going to be the party of no. They were going to relish that role. They've behaved with great discipline. They've been on message. And maybe one of the few things that's confounded them actually has been how to handle the Tea Party stuff. But that's a roundabout way of saying I'm also wondering if the Democrats and Obama haven't invited some of this by not seizing the initiative more vigorously for those 2 years. You know, when you try to coddle terrorists, you rarely get anywhere.
And
I'm not saying he deserves this. I'm not saying it's good for the country. But that first signal went out, you know, a day or two after Obama took office. And, you know, the Democrats kind of fumbled this in a lot of ways. And that's why we're now looking
at public relations. They were just abysmal. Record so
yeah,
far.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And the Republicans have been, you know, brutally and, you know, pretty much, you know, on message. You know, they've said it's not about, you know, we have to close the deficit. It's not about jobs. It's about budget deficit reduction. And they've had Joe Lieberman helping them out, too. And
didn't that infuriate you?
Sure. He voted against the bill. But again, you know, what did we expect? We've coddled people like this. We've allowed them to come into being and to flourish, and this is what we get.
Yep. No, it's pretty bad, I gotta say. But we're looking at one thing I was curious about is that if we have you heard anything, any more news on the referendums in Washington and not Washington and. Wisconsin, there's a call of the governor.
Yeah, I don't know how much steam those things have. We're all watching, and we won't know the results for a while.
Kasich has a big
referendum in Ohio.
Yeah. Oh, that's right, in Ohio. I thought they were trying to recall the Wisconsin governor, too.
There's movement, but I don't think that has a lot of sea legs under it. You know, Wisconsin is more about trying to get more recall of the senators, remember, and they had, I don't know if that's what you're referring to, where I think it was like six of the senators were on the ballot for recall who pushed for the anti-union
right.
bill
and
that Walker did.
Yeah,
right, and the thing with the governor didn't go anywhere.
It didn't go anywhere.
Two of the six labor candidates did win in Wisconsin for the Senate, but they needed three to actually be able to override, you know, to get rid of that horrible law. So they felt they came close,
sure.
Fell short. And then
well,
now
it's
all,
amazing to me that there's so much resistance out there for public unions. You know,
it's really frightening. And, you know, I've been thinking about this because we've been out of power for, you know, we finally got our power back after the 11th day. And I think nearly we just got our power back this morning. And so I've been reflecting on this. And I just think that, you know, this power outage, and I'm backtracking a little bit here, but I am trying to answer your question. We, you know, government has ceded control of this country to the corporations.
Yeah.
We deregulated energy and transportation in other industries. Every time you hear about deregulation, it's going to be good for the consumers. And electrical deregulation in Connecticut was supposed to be great for the consumers. Well, no, it was great for the pigs at Northeast Utilities.
We're paying the highest rates in the country right now. Sure.
And I guess my point is we're so enthralled to the corporations and we have such political timidity that it's created this climate for the anti-government, pro-corporate people to take over. So, you know, when you talk about this disdain for public employees, you're absolutely right. It's very real because we've been scapegoated for, 20 to 30 years. We're part of that anti-government chant that comes out of the Tea Party folks and everyone else. And that's the message I'm talking about, the Rush Limbaughs of the world and Bill O'Reilly's and the Republicans in Congress have been beating the drums about. Right, it's the paraprofessional, it's the sanitation worker, it's the correction officer, you know, how dare these workers have pensions and health care? That's what's driven the economy to the brink, not the Wall Street guys, not the deregulation, you know, not the complete abandonment of every principle so that we can have a nation of corporations. I think that's the problem, and I think that's what precipitated. This wasn't about snow and ice downing the trees and the wires. This was about giving a corporation, in this case the utility company, so much power and not asking for any accountability in return, and this is what you get. And at the same time, for the last 30 years, we've been dismantling public services, which is to say the jobs that Lila does, the jobs that our members do, educating kids, cleaning streets, tending to parks, making sure the sewer and water systems are functioning. You look at the storm, DPW crews are so short-staffed, they can't get out and answer calls. In my town, which was one of the hardest hit in the state, if not the hardest hit, cops can't keep up with all the problems because they haven't filled positions on the force. So, you know, you just have this snowball effect where you have this anti-government, anti-public employee rhetoric. We're going to keep taxes down. We're going to slash public services. Well, guess what happens? A storm hits, and you see the results. You have no workers to clean up. You have a utility company that cares more about its own executive salaries, that hasn't done any tree trimming, that hasn't laid underground wire, that hasn't done any infrastructure repair. So it all comes together. You know, that, to me, that's what it's about, Leo. Is that we've had 30 years of bashing unions.
Price at both ends. We're paying it financially, and we're paying it in pain.
You know, a lot of people mock. Yeah. You're paying for their ineptitude, and you're paying for their greed.
What do you think Malloy's going to do? What do you think? He's been pretty vocal.
I've been impressed with that. He got up and walked out of the press conference. He's refused to be in the same room with the CEO, but you know, I hate to use the cliche, the proof is in the pudding. But you know, if legislators want to do something meaningful, they'll revisit the electrical deregulation bill that Roland put into law in 1999. They'll clamp down on the utilities. Start laying infrastructure programs down. You know, we represent workers. For example, in Norwalk, it's called the third taxing district. We represent workers. There are six Connecticut municipalities that essentially pay for and supply their own power. And those communities did not get affected seriously by either Albert or Irene. Norwalk is a great example. Our members have been part of they've been trimming trees. In Norwalk, they've been putting wires, you know, cables underground. They've been doing aggressive tree trimming. They keep their staffing levels higher for the municipal utilities. Maybe that's the answer, is that we gotta get some competition to these greedy utilities. And the way you do that is you invest in the public sector. The private sector is about greed.
I agree 100% with you, Larry. And we really want to thank you for taking your time off the picket line to be with us.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, this is great. And sorry I was late. And I'll, keep following on council4.org, and we'll keep you abreast of the strike.
Okay. And we hope to have you on again in the next couple of weeks.
Whenever you're ready, give me a shout.
Try to get you on the first of each month, but,
appreciate
with power outages and whatnot, it's a little hard to do that.
Well, I just got my power back today, so it's good to hear your voices.
Yeah, we blew half last week, actually, Wednesday we couldn't get our power back. So
it makes you feel any better. None of the Northeast Utilities guys were without power, so.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Larry.
Thanks so much.
Take care.
That was Larry Dorman from the AFSCME Union.
Yeah.
And we now want to go to our music for
Woody
and the Ring. Woody. step into the ring with Woody.
Thank you, Lila. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the rope as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NBA news, my Stone Cold Locks, little NFL talk, Happy Valley, not so happy, and a little bit of baseball. Okay, let's get down to it. In a letter to the National Basketball Players Association, NBA Commissioner David Stern outlined the worsening terms that will be offered after 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time Wednesday, unless the union agrees to the owner's roughly 50-50 split of basketball-related income and various salary cap and luxury tax restrictions. The lesser terms include a 47% split of BRI, a rollback of current contracts, and a hard cap, according to a person with knowledge of the letter who requested anonymity because he was not authorized to go public. Also, Atlanta-based poll position finds 76% of nationwide surveys say they do not miss NBA games. 12% do, and 12% have no opinion. Ouch. I think you find that if the union were to take a vote now, that they may, you know, the majority would vote to take the 50-50 split. But the majority is not driving, you know, what the Players Association say. There's a few guys that are in the union that, you know, that are not in the majority, that are in the minority, that are kind of driving this whole thing. And I think they're kind of taken away from the, you know, from the rest of the group. Like, as I said, you know, this should, as a union, you would want to put this to a vote, whether to accept or not to accept. And the guy who's representing the players is Derek Fisher, and he's not taking it to a vote, which is kind of weird. You would think you'd want to take it to a vote, but that's not what's being done. And hey, if, you know, X amount of owners, you know, are saying they're losing money during the season, then hey, they could lose less money by not having a season. You know, as I've said all along, I don't think there's going to be an NBA season, and I think that it's probably, you know, going to take the threat of not having two NBA seasons in order for this to get done. I would doubt very much that a deal is done and we're going to have the NBA at all this year, which is kind of a shame because the playoffs last year were a lot of fun. Okay, moving on to my Stone Cold Locks. Even though we were not on air last week, I made my own picks, and I'm at 16-10-1. There are a lot of close games, just kind of blew me away, and I just kind of screwed up my picks. However, for my Stone Cold Locks for this upcoming weekend, I am going to take the Giants getting 3.5. The Giants getting 3.5. Now, usually it's a mistake to take the Giants, and, you know, they'll probably screw me, but I'm going to take them anyway. The next game I'm going to take the Dolphins giving the Redskins 3.5. Redskins stink. They have no offense whatsoever, and the Dolphins are kind of better than their garbage record. I also like the Bears at home giving the Lions 1. Bears are much improved. Now, this past weekend, I had watched a few of the games, and one of the games in particular that I watched was the Giants versus the New England Patriots. A very good game because, for one, the Patriots lost, which was great. And, you know, they've been exposed the last couple weeks in a row. Pittsburgh exposed them, and now the Giants have exposed them, and Dallas kind of exposed them as well, even though Dallas didn't win. The Patriots defense is absolute garbage. You can pass on them and you can run on them. And if you knock Tom Brady down a couple times, you give him a hard time, he's not Joe Montana. So that's how you beat the Patriots. The Patriots, you know, seem like, you know, they're going to kind of have an early exit in the playoffs again this year. I don't see them going very far. And I think it's a lack of talent more than anything else. It has nothing to do with the kind of schemes they run. It's just that they're, you know, a couple of bad drafts have finally caught up with them. Another game that I watched was the Jets against Buffalo. Big game for the Jets in Buffalo. The Jets kind of went back to who they were. You know, at halftime was 3-0. They were relying a little bit on field position and defense. Their defense looked really good. They put their running game together a little bit. And, you know, they beat Buffalo when they needed to beat Buffalo. So, you know, good for the Jets. Now, another game that I watched was the Monday night game, was the Bears over the Eagles. Now, everybody and their brother picked the Eagles, Michael Vick, yada, yada. What people have forgotten is that the Bears have put in some new blocking schemes to keep Jay Cutler off his back. And to keep Jay Cutler off his back, he's got one of the best arms in the NFL, And the small windows that he whips balls into his receivers are, it's just unbelievable. Some of the passes he just throws is just unbelievable. That, their running game looked great. The Bears defense is very fast. They've got a badass front four, and their linebackers are also fleet-footed. And they, you know, they kept Vic, they contained Vic, and, you know, that's what it's all about. And they turned the ball over a few times, and, you know, hey, they won in Philly on a Monday night, which was a great win for the Bears. And they had plenty of time to build up for it. They had a bye. You know, dudes got healthy, and I'm sure they, you know, they put together a great game plan. Now, going from a great game plan to, God, how did things went so wrong in Pennsylvania? Happy Valley is no longer a happy place. If you've been living under a rock, that's the only way you could be if you have not heard about the current sex scandal that is going on at the Pennsylvania State University. You have a guy who used to coach there, Sandusky. God, he's a big individual. I actually saw him giving an interview on the doorstep of his house. He looked to be about 6'3". Apparently, some 9 years ago, a graduate assistant saw him in the shower sodomizing a 10-year-old boy. The grad student then left the building, called his father. His father said to tell Joe Paterno. He allegedly told Joe Paterno, and then Paterno told the athletic director, who basically works for Paterno, and nothing ever happened, and the cover-ups just kept going on and on. Supposedly a few janitors saw some hanky-panky going in the locker room, and I guess they were threatened. One of them is in a home now. The other has just disappeared off the face of the earth. I find it extremely hard to believe that Joe Paterno had no knowledge of, you know, what was going on. He's going to deny it to the bitter end. He actually had the audacity to say he wanted to coach this weekend, which was really unbelievable. I just couldn't believe that he had the nerve to say he wanted to coach this weekend when, you know, you have victims out there and everything else. It's just mind-boggling, the audacity of this guy. I mean, he should just retire and be done with it. But apparently he wants to drag this one out, and that's what he's going to do. But I don't think for much longer. I think the school is probably going to let him go. But we'll have to wait and see. You know, every dog has his day, and he hasn't said anything yet, but maybe we'll get a chance to hear what he has to say. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I just can't believe that someone would see a man having sex with a child and not report it to the police. To make matters even worse, the grad student then became a coach. He's a receivers coach for Penn State. And then since then, this guy Sandusky has been, like, coming around practices with 10-year-old boys and 8-year-old boys. And, you know, Sandusky and the guy make eye contact. And the guy, you know, Sandusky knows that he saw him doing what he was doing because, you know, it's just unbelievable. I don't understand the mindset of some people. It's just shocking how things could just continue to go on. And Sandusky kept having access. You know, he was there for close practices. Paterno was more than well aware of that. I mean, he was in the weight room. He still had an office on Penn State. I mean, it's just, the stuff just goes on, and the story is only going to get worse. So, you know, if you're not into sports or whatever, it's still a very interesting story. I mean, Joe Paterno has been a coach at Penn State for 46 years, and it's certainly a rotten way to go out, but, you know, his time is certainly past, and he's definitely going out, and it's not going to be too pleasant. Speaking of not too pleasant, a former Seton Hall basketball player has been sentenced to 3 years in state prison for his role in an armed robbery at a house near the school's northern New Jersey campus. Kelly Whitney pleaded guilty in August to burglary, conspiracy, and criminal restraint charges as part of a plea bargain with Essex County prosecutors. The plea came nearly 3 months after Whitney's trial ended with a deadlocked jury. The Star-Ledger of New York reported that Whitney will be eligible for parole in October 2012. He played for Seton Hall from 2002 to 2006. Okay, a little bit of baseball talk. The fallout from the 99-loss season for the Minnesota Twins has started with the firing of general manager Bill Smith. Bill Smith was dismissed Monday when the Twins returned Terry Ryan to the role of an interim basis. Smith was Ryan's top assistant when Ryan stepped down in 2007, citing burnout after holding the job for 13 years. With the Twins widely recognized for their stability and ability to make the most out of a medium-range payroll, This was a startling move for them, despite the embarrassment of the 2011 season after two consecutive American League Central titles. This is the first time since the franchise moved from Washington to Minnesota in 1961 that the Twins have fired a GM. So things are changing up there. Another GM for the Baltimore Orioles. They announced the hiring of Dan Duquette as Executive Vice President of Baseball Operations. He signed a three-year contract Sunday. He'll be introduced in the news conference this morning. Duquette, 53, has not worked in a major league front office since 2002. He has served as general manager for the Montreal Expos and the Boston Red Sox. So we'll see how that goes in Baltimore, but I doubt very much if anything will happen down there. And that's it for this week. Shout out for all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, Greg at AFS, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, and my partner, Money Mike. That's it for this week. Enjoy the fall weather.
Thank you, Woody.
Special care must be taken to avoid red-hot elements or a spark of any kind that could ignite the fumes from the solvent. I have found that an electric rice cooker boils the solvent off very effectively. Bring the solvent oil mix in the rice cooker to a boil. Use a fan to carry the fumes from the solvent away. As the solvent boils off, continue adding more solvent oil mix until it is gone. As the level in the boiling pot comes down for the last time, add 8 to 10 drops of water. Since the boiling point of water is much higher than the boiling point of the solvent used, this water that was added allows the solvent to be released as the oil thickens. As the last of the solvent is being released, it is a good idea to lift the rice cooker and keep the contents in the cooker moving. This helps release any remaining solvent and also protects the oil from too much heat. At no time should the temperature of the oil go over 290 degrees Fahrenheit. Gently pour the oil from the rice cooker into a small metal container. Put this container with the oil into a dehydrator, or put the container on a gentle heating device, such as a coffee warmer. It may take a few hours to evaporate the water off the oil. In the end, there should be no bubbling or other activity on the surface of the oil. When the oil is hot, it is quite runny, but as it cools, the oil takes on the consistency of a thick grease. Generally, a pound of good hemp bud will produce about 2 ounces of high-grade oil. Ingesting this amount of oil over a 2 to 3 month period is enough to cure most serious cancers.
Wow.
Yeah, that definitely was amazing. And you can go to a YouTube on that one and find out hemp oil used to cure diabetes, cure cancer, cures everything.
Any kind of infection.
Yeah. Oil hemp used to cure diabetes. Now, let's just see. We still got a minute or two. This is 3 minutes. Let's see how this cures diabetes.
So what we're talking about here is
Reverend Tom Brown, First Church.
Our hero. Jack Herer, the author of The Emperor Wears No Clothes. So what we're talking about here with Jack Herer's legs is that Jack is unfortunately afflicted with diabetes. And as a result of the diabetes, you can see there are
80% of my legs have gone 100%, no feeling in them at all.
Numb. The progression of diabetes is loss of circulation, loss of nerve tissue, and scratches and scrapes, ulcers, gangrene, amputation, and death. That's the progression of the disease.
Yeah, but not now.
Not now. Because of the holy anointing oil, which is exactly as described in the Bible in Exodus 30, and it contains 16 ounces of marijuana for every quart of oil that is produced. So what we've done is we've been rubbing Jack's legs with this holy anointing oil right out of the Bible, and Jack's lesions have all gone away, the swelling has all gone away, the edema, the ulcers that he had have all been healed, and we haven't done this regularly since January. He only got a treatment from the end of October, November, and December. So we're only talking 2.5 months of treatment. This is holy anointing oil. This is the oil right out of the Bible. So you can see it's a nice green color. Now, this particular batch is the first time I did a multi-temperature extraction. So I extracted it at a very low temperature, and I got all the green color from the botanical material that would come out at a low temperature without being changed the way any green leaf, when you cook it, changes color. It's got some of the raw green in there. And then I cooked it at two higher temperatures successively to develop more and more of the botanical materials that were susceptible to extraction at the higher levels of heat. And previously, I'd been just cooking it to one high temperature. And I noticed that I was losing botanicals when I first start the process and I'd first be cooking it. There'd be this beautiful green color, and then it would fade and turn brownish. And I'm going, well, what happened to that nice green color? I really like that. And then I thought, well, in my recipe, I'll just use a third of the oil, low temperature, a third medium temperature, and a third high temperature. Did it the first time, and I got that beautiful green, came right into it. So this has got 1 ounce of marijuana equivalent in every ounce of oil. Okay, so that's 32 ounces per quart, 32 fluid ounces per quart. quart, which is twice as much as the Bible recipe. The Bible recipe actually only calls for 16 ounces per quart of oil, which would be half an ounce per ounce. Half an ounce of marijuana per fluid ounce. So this is the stuff that we've used to heal Jack Harrah's legs. So here's a man who dedicated his life to an herb, and now the herb's saving his life.
How about that? That's pretty cool.
Very, very good. And I'm going to refer you to this on YouTube, which is the cure for says cinnamon treatment success for diabetes type 2 as well. And so you can check that out on YouTube. Hemp is a cure for everything. That's why it's illegal, folks. They would
put the pharmaceutical companies
right
out of business.
Right the hell out of business.
You wouldn't need Prozac. You wouldn't need poisons, chemical poisons to kill cancer. You wouldn't need all kinds of things.
Yep. And just at the end tonight, I guess we should probably... This is a kind of a critical article. It has to do with health care, but mostly Social Security. And, oops, we can't get it. No, that's okay. It's been deleted. Okay, well, that was from even register.
And what did it say exactly? What was the title of that? Justice Department seeks to pass rule allowing government officials to lie.
Yeah, this one's interesting. And this is from naturalnews.com, but unusual article in that it talks about the Freedom of Information Act and how the government is trying to make it legal for those agencies to lie.
Didn't get that one either.
That's something. This is
what happens sometimes with.
Well, it's interesting too that you have to
controversial put, articles.
You have to really wonder if sometimes too if the these articles are being scratched from the internet. Not that the website is, but that that they're not allowing these articles to come up. I read it earlier today, but sometimes it just came out today, so.
Well, we're almost ready to go off the air anyway.
Yeah. So
hopefully
we can
read this to you.
But it doesn't seem to want to come up. I don't know why.
Oh, here it is.
If it stays up now. Okay. Justice Department seeks to pass rule allowing government officials to lie in response to freedom of information requests.
A powerful tool that allows ordinary citizens to obtain crucial information from government archives, the U.S. Department of State Freedom of Information Act, is under attack. The Daily Caller reports that the U.S. Justice Department wants to revise a law to allow government officials to lie about or conceal the very existence of records that it does not wish to release to the public. The Justice Department claims that the law needs to be revised to protect sensitive information from being released, but current FOIA provisions already exempt certain information from having to be supplied as long as those requesting the information are given a proper explanation as to why it cannot be released. But the new rule would allow officials to not only conceal the information, but also blatantly lie about it. In other words, when the federal government wants to keep certain dirty tricks secret under wraps, even secrets not protected by the exemption, it will simply be able to tell those requesting such information that it does not exist.
The rule will dramatically undermine government integrity by allowing a law designed to provide public access to government information to be twisted to permit federal law enforcement agencies to actively lie to the American people. The American Civil Liberties Union and Citizens for Responsible Ethics in Washington and opengovernment.org. The freedom of information requests, of course, have been crucial in exposing all kinds of government corruption, and an FOI request exposed U.S. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano as a liar concerning the state the safety of Transportation Security Administration, TSA, naked body scanners, for instance. The problem is, if you're a FOIA requester and the agency says they don't have the records, you have no reason to doubt that, says Crew Chief Counsel Ann Wiseman, concerning the proposal. But if they cite an exemption, you have the option to sue. The proposed FOIA revisions were first published back in March, and the Justice Department began taking public comments on them for a short period of time. Due to a massive public backlash, the agency is once again accepting comments. You can submit your own comments by contacting the Office of Information Policy, Suite 1425 New York Avenue, Northwest Washington, Connecticut, Washington, D.C., 20530, or you can call 202-514-3642, and...
best way, if you want to get in touch, is to go to the article and take down the information.
If you can find the article on the site, you know...
Naturalnews.com,
all right, and look for Justice Department Seeks to Pass Rule Allowing Government Officials to Lie in Response to FOIA Requests. And with that, we're going to say goodnight, and we thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the show. And Lila will be off for the next rest of the week, taking a short vacation to D.C. to join the Occupy D.C. movement. Yeah, with her grandson, to see her grandson.
So
anyway, that's the way it is.
I hope you guys have a nice week, and I look forward to talking to you next week.
Yeah. And
good night, folks.
Good night, everybody. And we want to go away here. Have a great night.